Good morning. Thank you very much for joining us for the webinar. As I mentioned before, we'll be monitoring questions throughout, so go ahead and type them into the question box. I'm Julie Taylor, Director of Academic Relations for Fulbright, and we're looking forward to going over a lot of best practices for editing your awards. The editing awards is really the lowest cost, highest impact method for improving recruitment for our awards. So we'd really appreciate it if you take the time for reviewing each one of the awards. And we're especially dependent upon you because if you have an award that is very particular to a university, really only you can figure out where that sweet spot is in which you can make the award as flexible as possible and yet still be very appealing to the host university. So we're really relying on you in order to make changes that will make the award have broader appeal. And I'd say that one of the things to keep in mind, at the forefront of your mind when you're going through your awards, is to examine every award through the eyes of the applicant. I think that's something that we sort of struggled with in the past, and so we really encourage you to do so when you're going through this time. So in order to help you with that perspective, I wanted to give you a little bit of information about who our applicants are. Now, the average age of an applicant is 52 years old, which means that they tend to be more senior professors who would be at the higher end of the pay scale and possibly have a lower teaching load than the average. And the teaching loads in the United States, I wanted to go over. For a tenure line position in an elite research school now, it tends to be around a 2-1. If many of your awards are STEM, one thing that you might want to consider is the fact that many people in the sciences also have grants in which they buy out their courses. So they may be lower than a 2-1. They could be a 1-1 or even lower than that. So, you know, when you're thinking about teaching awards in STEM, you need to kind of bear that in mind because they might not be used to carrying a full course load. At a research school for a tenure line position, and by tenure line I mean assistant, associate, or full professor, so they are in line to get tenure or have tenure, the average is a 2-2, whether it's a state, university, or private. Then for lecturers and instructors at either a research or a teaching school, it tends to be 3-3 or 4-4. And a lot of schools that you think of as traditional teaching schools are starting to evolve into research schools, and so they are attempting to reduce their course loads. If you're a professor or an instructor at a community college, the load tends to be 4-4 or a 4-5, and that means that you have 4 courses in each semester or 5 courses in each semester. So I wanted to give you some information on faculty salaries. Now, this isn't trying to encourage you to necessarily go towards the high end on the faculty salaries, but I think that when you examine your awards, you'll see that many of them are actually not commensurate with the salary of the professor in the United States. I know that many of you have the tendency to think, well, that's much more than a professor makes in my country, but when you're recruiting people from the U.S., they're still having to carry their mortgage in the U.S. They still have many expenses, including student loans and things like that, that they're having to pay off when they are on the award. So you don't have to be up to their salary in order for your award to be appealing, but you do want to start trying to get them in the ballpark. So for full professors at a public university, it's $130,000, and at private universities, $176,000. Now, that's in part because there are a lot of professors at private universities who are making a ton of money. And so I think that's being pulled a little bit high, but if you're looking to attract elite professors, it's going to take quite a bit of funding in order to attract them unless they have already a strong reason for wanting to come to your country. Associate professors, 93,000 at public, 118 at private. Assistant professors, 81,000 in public, 103,000 in private. There's been an increase in salaries overall over the last 2 years in the U.S. Lecturers and instructors, it's 62,000 at public and 76,000 at private. When you look through our awards catalog, most of the stipends are actually pegged more towards the lecture instructor level. And so in order for people to take the awards, we're assuming that their university is going to be topping off the award either as sabbatical or as a straight top-up with them taking a research leave. And so that's increasing the burden on universities in order for people to take Fulbright. Just something to keep in mind. If you have flexibility in that area, you might want to look at your stipend amount. I think when you pull that open, I'm not able to move the slide forward. Okay. So why is it that we need to market our awards? I know that sometimes this sounds very unappealing to have to try and make a sale of a Fulbright, but we really do want to actively encourage people to take the awards. After all, Fulbright is a well-known program, and those who know us really love us, so why would we have to go out and actively market our awards? And I think one of the reasons that makes it so imperative that we start thinking along these lines now is that so many of the awards in the catalog are now targeted towards STEM, which is a change that has occurred over time, but now it's a significant amount of the catalog. We are neither well-known nor competitive with those audiences. They have many options on fellowships, and they also have the grant options. The grant options, almost all of them pay more than we're able to provide. And many of them just really don't know anything about fellowships. That's just not very traditional for people in the sciences and engineering. So we're attempting to improve that in our outreach, but it is something to bear in mind when you're looking at your awards and trying to make them more appealing. Something. Okay, so there's five characteristics of applicants. One, they're comparison shoppers. Two, they skim the awards. When they're reading them, they skim rather than fully reading them. They dislike uncertainty. They like flexibility. And they procrastinate. And I'm sure that if you've been with this program long enough, you've seen all of these things. So applicants are comparison shoppers. They are not limiting, they are not saying to themselves, oh, I really want a Fulbright Award. Some of them are, but that's a pretty limited audience. So they're not just searching in our catalog. They often examine opportunities to go abroad and to remain in country in order to do their research. So they're also just not looking at only opportunities to go abroad. And many of the domestic opportunities in the United States pay more than a Fulbright. For instance, the Library of Congress has opportunities here that are very appealing for people. They tend to pay over $100,000 a year. They look at both fellowships and grants. And before, that used to be limited to really the sciences and engineering, but now it's being encouraged throughout the academy. So there are now grants for people in the humanities and the social sciences, and their deans are actively encouraging them on the grants more so than on the fellowships. So given this intense competition, what is it that sets your award apart and makes it a very special opportunity? Is it the level of service that your commission provides? Because remember, one advantage that we have over a lot of these other opportunities is that we have so many people involved in supporting those who go abroad in this program. And I think that that's really attractive to people. Is it other engagement opportunities that you're going to have? Is it offering housing? That's very rare on fellowships, and so that's also very attractive. Is it very easy to have medical services in your country? If so, obviously Americans get very excited about that. But what is it that really sets your award apart? That also includes in your country, like what is very appealing about that location or about that particular institution and the type of people that they can collaborate with. So we may not be able to change the stipends in many of these cases and make them more lucrative opportunities, but we might be able to highlight other things that would be very appealing. So they skim the award descriptions. So applicants compare awards based on skimming. So they're usually looking at multiple awards and just looking very casually across all of them. It's really unlikely that they were fully read the award until they begin to apply. And while this may be very annoying for you and you may think, wow, you know, I only want people who will actually read my award, and that's very understandable. There are many studies that indicate that this is completely human nature and that it's not just limited to professors, that people tend to skim in a variety of situations. So there's really nothing that we can do about the fact that people skim the awards. We can only adapt to those circumstances. So given that applicants skim awards, titles should clearly indicate what the award is about. You want to get that as front and center on your award as possible, because this we want to improve clarity and searchability. Also, using U.S. spelling of words. So remember, they're putting in key words, and they're trying to do a search. So you want for them, if they're looking for things related to national defense, that they're able to pull up that award. So you'd want to be using the U.S. spelling. The stipend should be in U.S. dollars. I realize that can be problematic for you. Go ahead and add language stating that the final total will depend upon the exchange rate. But think about it. If they are looking at multiple awards, they need to know right away in order to continue focusing on your award exactly what the award amount is going to be. And also, since they're skimming, you really want to front load the description with the highlights. Now, it may be that there's considerable explanation of some of those highlights that is needed. Go ahead and save that for some of the other tabs. But right at the very front, just really go with your strengths on that award. Okay.
There you go.
Okay. The other attribute is that applicants dislike uncertainty. So Jordana made me change that. I actually had written applicants abhor uncertainty because that is the extent to which they really don't like it if they cannot tell exactly what is being offered and what will be expected of them. And many of our award descriptions are very nebulous and require the candidate to have to call in order to figure out what's going on. And that increases recruitment costs, and it means that if they are having to call, that we are, for every single one of those calls, we can expect that we are losing multiple people who were interested in that award but just didn't bother to call because they couldn't tell what it was about. So, for instance, they want to know exactly the number of teaching hours or classes that they will be teaching. On many of our awards, this is not clear, and it remains a point that must be negotiated. And I really discourage that because it's a big turnoff to the applicants. What is the advising load? Sometimes this is being presented to people as though it's a big benefit of the award. Wow, you get to do advising of our students. But when you think about it from the perspective of the professor, one of the things they enjoy leaving behind is the fact that they're having to advise a bunch of students back home. So if you can kind of, yes, we want for them to engage students and to advise, but the more specific you can be about what's being required and maybe make that sound a little more exciting, that, you know, they're going to be engaging students from that country, and you know, just make it sound a little more exciting than the fact that they're going to be doing exactly the same job they just left behind, but just in another location. Is housing included? It's often very unclear whether or not housing is included on some of our awards. So the more you can clarify these things, the better. So just continuing along with that theme, definitely try to make things as clear as possible. For instance, there are many sort of nebulous statements inside the award descriptions, such as collaboration with host faculty. I think in most cases we mean that we want for them to engage with host faculty, but collaboration in the U.S. means that you're actively working on a joint project together. And so if people are coming over in order to do research in your country and they have presented their own research project, they don't also want to be working on a separate project with the local faculty. And that's, in most cases, not what you're actually saying. That doesn't preclude them from making ties at the university that then will lead to joint collaboration. As we've seen, that often occurs. But they become very confused by statements like this. What does appropriately qualified professionals will be considered mean? What's appropriate? Who decides that? Does year-long refer to an academic year or 12 months? Very important for them when they're doing their planning. What does any appropriate institution mean? Okay, we're reading a question right now.
So the question is, does this idea of highlights versus tab information mean that the format of the catalog will be changed? Currently, we do not have much flexibility on what goes where.
This is Jordana. It's going to pretty much remain consistent in terms of the layout, but there's pretty large text boxes in the grant activity section, and that's where a lot of the uncertainty sometimes is in that grant activity section where you're describing what the candidate will be doing. So that's where that clarity is going should really come in, is in that grant activity text box.
The first tab.
Mm-hmm. In the first tab, exactly. It's that first text box in the first tab. And I think there was another question just asking you to explain what a 2-1 is for those who might not understand.
Yeah, so I mentioned that, but I'll go back over it again. So that indicates what their teaching load is per semester. Granted, some universities in the United States are on a quarter system, and so there would be 3 quarters that would comprise their teaching load. But in most cases, it's 2 semesters. And so you'd teach, for instance, a 2-2 would be 2 courses in each semester. So continuing with disliking uncertainty, consistency throughout the award. We get more calls on consistency issues than on anything else. It's very confusing for people. And if we receive a call, like I said, we can assume that there's many people experiencing the same confusion who just sort of end up dropping off and don't end up applying. So, for example, PhD required in one section, and then it'll say PhD preferred in another. Or it'll say that that professionals can be are welcome to apply for the award, but then it's a research and teaching award, and we don't know whether or not they can do a professional project. It's also very good to use active voice and to clarify who is responsible for what. So who is it that determines the 50-50 teaching research breakdown? Who is it that's going to determine whether or not housing is available? What is the process that has to occur in order to determine that? I mean, what we would prefer is that you could just say housing is available or not available, but if you can't do that and it does involve some type of process, it needs to be clear to the candidate exactly who's initiating that and who ultimately decides.
Some of this IIE language, like appropriate professional, isn't it best if IIE or ECA defines what that is so that posts and commissions can decide if that is appropriate for the award? So, like, appropriately qualified professionals is in the catalog.
Okay. Yeah, we can. So I think one thing that we want to highlight is that last year we did add professional project as a grant activity type. So if you are open to professionals, we encourage you to select that as an activity type. So in addition to teaching and research, you are open to professional projects as well if you are encouraging a professionals in your country. So some countries might not be open to professionals, but we are striving for consistency with that professional project. And we have a page on our website that talks about some examples of professional projects. So that's another resource for you to look at if you're unclear what a professional project could be. We have some examples. So hopefully that answers the question about how we're attracting professionals.
And it's only on a few awards at this point, right?
Yeah, we have last year, our first year, we had about 17 grantees come under the professional project category, but we are hoping that more countries will really consider it since the program is very open to professionals as well as academics.
So continuing with disliking uncertainty, on many of the awards, the applicant is asked to negotiate with the host university. I understand that in some cases you can't do much about this, but I want to make sure everyone realizes that this is very unusual for them to have to do this. It's not that unusual if you're on a grant and then you're trying to contact that university as an individual in order to set up your own research, but it is sort of strange for a fellowship program because they're assuming that the fellowship program has already negotiated all of these things. So this is uncommon. Because it's uncommon, it's a bit of a turnoff. Applicants really want terms in writing too. So many times these negotiations are occurring over the phone, but they still feel very uncertain about what they can count on once they arrive in country because it hasn't been put into writing and it isn't something that you can see in the award description. They are discouraged by discipline or topic preferences. And I know that you're trying to encourage people in these areas in order to apply. And yes, it may have a bit of that effect. But there can be excellent scholars who you would be thrilled to have. And if they see a preference and it is not the thing that they do, their subject area and their project does not fit, then they will feel discouraged to apply. So what we think is a better practice is to eliminate the preferences if you can in the award description, and instead you can provide IIE with these preferences and that'll shape our recruitment strategy for your award. So then we can make sure that you get candidates who are in your preferred areas, but that we wouldn't dissuade anybody who would be an excellent candidate in a less preferred area. So as we mentioned in our email, they really like flexibility, especially on the big items. So like They like flexible award durations. They love the flex option. The scholar categories, so it really helps an award if people from all different levels can apply for that. And the award activities, if they can do research teaching, if they can kind of have more flexibility in deciding what that would be, they prefer all of that. You can't go wrong with making those things more flexible. Yet, when it starts to become like, oh, under you can either go to this institution or you can go to this institution or that institution, it starts to become, they like it open that they can choose the institution, but if there's sort of like a long list of institutions and then you're writing things about each one of the institutions, or the housing is available under certain circumstances, not under others, where you feel like you're providing flexibility because there is like a chance for them to do different things, it actually can sort of become overwhelming for them, and then it starts to introduce more uncertainty, and they have trouble sort of visualizing what the experience would be like on the award. So we really encourage you to go as flexible as possible on some of those, the big ticket items that they really care about, but to not let there be sort of, to still let the award be defined. When it's more undefined and they have so many choices and options, then it's like when you go into a Gap and they have 4,000 different types of jeans and you feel so overwhelmed that you just want to turn around and walk out. So we definitely encourage flexibility, and that's the main takeaway, but just make it on the larger items.
Okay, so a couple more questions. The concern was about what a terminal degree is in some cases, like a master's in TEFL. Is that considered professional, or can a terminal degree in master's be like an MFA, MBA, and then there's JD? So he's asking, I guess, now a terminal degree.
Yeah, so I think, so terminal degrees is actually something that is can be challenging, I think, because in different fields of study it is different. For example, a JD is the terminal degree in law. There are PhDs in business, but the MBA is the much more common degree, and MFA is the terminal degree in the arts. Because of this, because this can be confusing, we will look at a resource. We will try to find a resource that kind of spells out terminal degrees in the U.S. and circulate that to all of you, because I know that that is something challenging. So we'll look around at kind of what we think are the best resources that describe terminal degrees and circulate that after the webinar.
So as all of us know, applicants procrastinate. What was the statistic that you had in the email, Jordana?
About 50% start within 4 weeks. They start their application within 4 weeks of the deadline.
And there are some, especially if they've applied for something else recently, who will be trying to turn over an application in 1 week. And I used to work with grants and fellowships, and I would get professors walking in a few days before a deadline and be planning on applying for something. So it's not at all unusual. And I just want for you to bear in mind that really the more applications that we can get, the better quality awardees that we'll have just more people to choose from. So while nobody really likes to see a rushed application, and we've seen many of those, there are some people who have recently written an application for something else and have a top quality project, and they can turn it around quite quickly. So it's best to really make it easy for these procrastinators to apply. So we suggest you ease time-sensitive requirements when you can. So letters of invitation and external language evaluations. They can do the self-evaluation, but getting letters is obviously very difficult on a tight time frame. So if there is a letter, if a letter of invitation is just a must and you can't change anything on that, please ensure a working link and or an email to an institutional contact who is accessible and responsive. On many of the awards in which we received no applications, we have determined that's because a letter of invitation was required and the applicants were not able to reach anyone at those institutions. Especially in August, because people are procrastinators, they're going to be asking for those letters at the last minute. And we know that a lot of people at universities are on vacation in August. So if you could really contact them and encourage for there to be someone accessible during that month, I think it would really help recruitment prospects. And we had a little more to say about issuing letters of invitation. We suggest the practice of not requiring a letter of invitation for partnership awards that are located at one specific institution. Hosts can describe their preferences inside of the award description, and they may discuss their preferences with applicants when they call or email them. But if a partnership institution withholds a letter of invitation, it can be seen as sort of a pre-selection, so we recommend not requiring this for these partnership awards. Gaming selection by restricting LOIs, which is something we've seen from a few institutions, it undermines Fulbright's broader effort to curb bias and promote diversity. So the best practice is to bring the host university into the selection process of the recommended candidates rather than requiring the LOI upfront. We know that several of you do this.
Okay, so more questions about terminal wire lab. He's wondering. Okay,
so once you've reviewed each award, please be certain that everyone at the post or commission who answers applicant questions has read and understands the awards to ensure consistency in your responses. That's another thing that we receive many calls about, is when they're receiving information from the post or commission that contradicts what is in the award catalog. And update award information on your website, because we also receive calls about the award on the Poster Commission website being different than the award description in the catalog. So we think that that's because sometimes they're not updated. And take down old information and old web pages. And that not only helps with our marketing strategy, but you know, it creates considerable confusion when applicants go in and they type in the correct information and then suddenly this web page comes in and it has a application date from 2 years ago. So we've seen that a little bit. So those are three suggestions once you've reviewed your awards. And then I think we are just at the timeline. So here's the timeline that we sent out to you. So today's the 20th, and the post and commission edits are due on December 13th. That's a Friday. ECA approvals are due on January 17th. Happy holidays. And IIE review will be completed on January 31st, 2020. And we will go live with everything on February 3rd and release the catalog. So At IIE, we will review your awards and provide specific suggestions by early December. And please reach out to your IIE program officer and arrange a meeting for individualized assistance if you're interested. We are here and happy to help you. So that's it for me. Please go ahead and type in your questions now if you have any other concerns.
Yes, we have one question. In the case of the LOI, is it impossible for the commission to secure a functional link? It is impossible for the commission to secure a functional link for every single university or research institute. It would be much better if the applicants were informed by IIE in ahead of time that certain awards can be addressed sooner.
We do a lot of webinar guidance to our applicants who are interested in contact us about starting early and that the letter of invitation process is the most time-consuming process. So we do get out in front with that guidance, but you have to remember that a lot of people don't contact us. They're just reading the award descriptions and making their decisions from what's on the website. And so trying to make it as clear as possible in your description to make it helpful for those that never contact us or don't come to our webinars. But we do try to advise them as early as possible as we start our webinar guidance pretty early in the recruitment season.
Yeah, and that is especially an issue with those who are procrastinating till the very last minute. So they're not going to be seeing those webinars in many cases. Yeah. And as Athena said, it's a large percentage of the applicants.
Is all discipline dead today?
Is all disciplines dead today? Oh, Lord, I hope not.
No, it is very much alive. We are encouraging you all to be as flexible as possible and to have those all disciplines awards.
Yeah, they definitely receive more applications than the ones that are restricted, even when they're just restricted to kind of the large categories of STEM or social sciences and humanities. You just get so many more applicants with the all disciplines.
So for the ones that have preferences, specifically the all disciplines, should we just remove that from the description but email it to your team to keep it internal?
Yes,
the idea for all disciplines awards is that we truly want to make them all disciplines without a lot of preferences in there. So if you have recruitment preferences, we have a new internal box for you to include your recruitment preferences just in an internal note that doesn't get published. And that way you can really show to the applicant pool that you really truly are open to anyone in any discipline. But we can still target recruitment to specific areas that you might be more interested in just to see what we get. But we find that our applicants have a hard time interpreting a preference, and they might opt themselves out if they don't see their discipline listed in that preference. So we're really trying to make sure that all disciplines awards are truly open to all disciplines without a lot of preference language.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for joining us.
This is recorded.
And this is recorded, and we'll be sending out the link as well as a checklist to help you when you're reviewing your awards.
Thank you.
Thanks.